Blog Talk Radio. Monday, January 20th, 2014, and this is Foxology Today. I'm Silver Ray Fox, your host. I hope your day is going wonderful as we keep in mind and heart that this is the holiday honoring the great giant of a man, Dr. Martin Luther King. What an extraordinary man, and what an extraordinary legacy. Truly, honor is deserved. And it just goes to show you what can be achieved when there is the right kind of fight in you. Truly, there is a significant message left for us that encourages us to fight for those things that we believe in, particularly those things that are for the good of all. You bet. Well, while on the subject of the right kind of fight, sometimes they're the wrong kind of fight, and I'm talking about domestic violence. It is an unfortunate reality for so many victims, men, women, and children. It's the kind of fight that without intervention is too often a losing battle, not excluding even loss of lives, literally. There is hope, and there is help, however, as many caring organizations put forth a positive fight to help these individuals and families overcome these issues. It takes strong organizations, strong strategies, and a strong will to win. And that's what I'm talking about today with my special guest, Barbie Brashear, Fighting Domestic Violence, the Will to Win. Barbie is the executive director of the Harris County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, an organization that is standing tall in the fight against domestic violence. Welcome to the Foxology stage, Barbie. So happy to have you today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you inviting me to be on Silver Ray. It's a great day.
Yes, indeed it is. That's my philosophy every day. It's a great day. You just say so. Well, I'm glad to be talking with you. This is an important issue. And like a lot of other things, a lot is going on often in the what seemingly is in the backdrop of many lives and not so much always being talked about from a solution perspective. We hear a lot of unfortunate news. We hear a lot of bad news once it happens. But what we don't often get to hear a whole lot about is how many organizations like yours are really standing tall, fighting the fight against domestic violence. And so that's a great reason to have you on today. We're going to talk about that. And I want to tell anybody who is listening, this is going to be a four-part series, so this is just a beginning. I want to start talking about you, Barbie. I know you have a lot of history in this industry. So let's talk about you, how this all began for you, and why you're doing what you're doing currently.
Okay. Well, it goes back to 1992, actually, for me. My husband and I had moved to Texas. We had lived in Indiana, and we moved to Texas for my husband to go to school. And being desperate for money, I'm looking for a job. I had a bachelor's degree in social work, and I was kind of just looking for whatever, and there was an ad in the paper for what was called a resident advocate. I had no idea what that meant, and it was for working in a domestic violence shelter. And I interviewed for the job. I was hired, and I started working in the emergency shelter for women and children. And my job was to actually kind of be like the house mom, give orientation, do intakes for the women, answer the hotline. So I started listening to women share their stories. And when I was interviewed for the position, I was asked a question I had never been asked at any interview that I'd been on, and that was whether or not I had been a victim of domestic violence or I had known someone. And at that time, I answered no to the question. But after about a month working in the shelter and working with the women and hearing them share the stories and seeing the kiddos in the shelter, I just kind of had this realization that I knew what this really was at a very deep and personal level. And I went to my supervisor and said, look, you asked me this question when I interviewed. And at the time I said no, and I was being honest, but I really wasn't honest because what I've realized is that I grew up in a home where there was domestic violence. And I grew up feeling like and thinking that this was just normal. This is just what, you know, people did. They're just fighting. They get over it. They move on into the next thing. And so for me, I believe that's where my passion for the work was born, by really connecting to the women and the powerful stories and working to help them know that they could live lives free from abuse. And since 1992, I've been working in the field of – I worked in an emergency shelter for many years, and I had very many different positions there. I actually moved back to Indianapolis, Indiana, which was where my husband, we were from, both from small towns in Indiana, but we moved back to Indiana for a few years in the mid-90s. And I took a position working with a family advocacy program where I was actually partnered with two detectives and actually went to the homes where the police had been called and provided on-site advocacy to women. So these were women who had never been connected with resources before. So my role was to really help them think about safety planning, help them think about the level of risk that they're in because of this relationship, and then also to connect them to resources. So that was quite a learning experience for me doing that in the field. After that, after those couple of years, I actually moved back to Houston, back to Texas, and resumed a position at the agency I had been working at before and started working with a non-residential program, which meant that these were folks that didn't need shelter, but they needed counseling and legal services and other kinds of things. And I also started doing a lot of community outreach and training. And so I feel like I've kind of gotten the whole gamut of experiences in the field of domestic and actually sexual violence over the past, I guess it's over 20 years now. So in 2010, I accepted a position that I'm in now as the executive director for the Coordinating Council. And now we're working more at the macro level. We're working with the systems that respond rather than working directly with the victims and survivors. So it's been a very, I think, well-rounded education to the needs of the community as well as victims and survivors.
Yes, yes. Well, I would like to, before we get into all of those particulars, ask you a couple of questions about what you just said about your own life and the revelation that you got about your own situation. I would like you to answer two questions for me, Barbie. One, Why do you think you did not recognize that so immediately? I know you kind of said because I thought this was how families interacted, all of them. And then why do you think you were able to successfully go into your relationship long-term without having that experience? Is it because of the awareness and because you just would not in, on any level tolerate that yourself, because we know that there are many cycles that continue with this kind of tolerance, particularly
right.
women choosing situations that are threatening to them,
right.
Both self-esteem, mental and physically, and, you know, all the whole gamut of things that are destructive. So if you could answer that,
sure.
Had you actually seen other homes where you felt that this was normal? What was going through your mind that you could easily say no? And when you look back, why do you feel you didn't really know?
Sure. Well, so let me kind of describe how I grew up. So from the Midwest, my town, I call it a white bread cheese whiz kind of town. It was very undiverse, for lack of a better word. Folks were either factory workers or farmers, and many families did both. My parents were both factory workers. My earliest memories of the domestic violence, of the yelling and the pushing and the shoving and the actual physical things, happened very early in my life because my parents divorced when I was in third grade. So all of the really memorable times that I remember the physical violence happened before that. So, you know, probably around first or second grade is what I have memories of. And I also, you know, we didn't talk about it. These were things that happened and nobody ever talked about them. They just happened. So we didn't talk about them inside the family and we didn't talk about it outside the family either. So it was just kind of the norm. When my parents divorced in third grade, when I was in third grade, my dad left and we intermittently saw him and, you know, life just kind of carried on. And my mom being a single mom, trying to raise three kiddos on very little income, times were tough. And, we relied on, at the time it wasn't TANF, I think it was called AFDC back then, and food stamps and Medicaid and all those kinds of things. And so, again, I think I said this earlier, it just was kind of the norm, and it didn't ever get talked about, and no other families, I can't remember any other families talking about things. I think I grew up in a culture and a time and a climate where what happened in the family stayed in the family, and you didn't talk about it anywhere else, which I'm finding and found later as an adult that was true for a lot of us. And it wasn't until, again, in 1992 when I started working in the shelter, that I really understood what intimate partner violence was. It was my own professional education to the field of intimate partner violence and sexual violence that I really was given the opportunity to have some understanding of what it meant. I learned about the power and control that happens in relationships and all the dynamics around that. I learned about emotional abuse, verbal abuse, psychological abuse. Mostly what I learned is that domestic violence is a pattern. It's not a one-time occurrence. It's a pattern of behaviors that occur in a relationship. And that learning helped me have some realization that that's what happened in my own family. And going back to that idea of not talking about things, my family still doesn't talk about things. You know, when I realized that, right. I had this realization. I went to my supervisor and said, oh, I grew up in this kind of a home. And she said, yeah, that's true for a lot of us. And I called my mom 1,200 miles away and told her how excited I had this job. I couldn't wait to go to work every day. And guess what, Mom? I've learned you're a battered woman. And I can remember the silence.
I'm sure she was happy to hear you announce that.
She was right. It was terrible. She was shocked and she still doesn't believe it to this day. And, you know, we just don't talk about it.
Well, the reason I asked that question was for that reason. You said some key things, and that was one of them. And because this entire series is to bring about awareness and particularly to break that cycle of believing it's okay, to believing it's not what is really happening, that you're not being battered, you're being a part of a relationship where this kind of activity, as negative as it may be, is just the way relationships go. Not,
right.
That is just
right.
So unethical, and it is not true. And
right.
That was particularly why I wanted you to just break it open, to let people know, I don't care how frequently you've seen it, I don't care who you know that's been there, who you know that's in it, what the picture is, it is not an acceptable situation, and it is in no way to be considered normal or healthy. That has
Absolutely.
To be put across. No, in no form or fashion is it normal or healthy to exist in that kind of situation. So thank you for sharing that. Let's talk about, off the top now, what your organization that you're working for in Houston is doing. And I know it's extensive, but let's talk about those things that can be first achieved for people who may be listening who need help right now.
Okay. So I'll give you some history about the organization and what we're doing, and then kind of lead into giving some information for folks about what they can do right now. The Coordinating Council was formed in 1996 by the area leaders. So they were the chief of police at the time, the Harris County District Attorney, the sheriff, and then the executive directors of some of the leading domestic violence programs in Harris County. And what was happening across the country was, and it was work that was coming out of Minnesota and based on the work of Ellen Pence and the Duluth model, but there was this idea, this approach, this kind of concept for communities to develop what was called a coordinated community response. So basically urging communities to start building connections and relationships among the system so that survivors and victims didn't fall through the cracks. And so in 96, those folks got together, said, let's start doing this. And the idea was to start thinking about what were best practices approaches for the systemic responses. And by systems, we're talking about law enforcement, the criminal justice system, the advocacy service providers, healthcare system, adult and child protective services. So some of those major large systems where folks interact, where folks find themselves when they're seeking services or seeking support or calling the police and things like that. So what we found in starting this work in 96 was that Harris County is pretty large. You know, we're the third largest county in the United States. There's hundreds of medical service providers. There's, you know, if you count every kind of law enforcement organization in the county, there's over 70 different law enforcement organizations. There are, you know, 14 to 15 different domestic violence responding agencies, and that doesn't include some of the faith-based ones that operate out of churches and faith communities. So
yes.
It's really large, and we're serving a large population, so it needs to be large. And what we were finding is that we don't know everything that everybody is doing, and how can we create a seamless system of care for our community if we don't even know each other? And so that's kind of what we've really dedicated our organization to doing is increasing communication, thinking about ways that we can cooperate more with one another through the systems, and then also kind of challenging ourselves as systems to think about, one, how do we put providing services and access to services for victims at the forefront of our work rather than our systems or our organizations so that
yes.
we make it easier for folks, right?
Yes.
So, you know, if you pick up the phone and you call 911 because of domestic violence, you could trigger, you know, your whole family to entering into, you know, five or six different kinds of systems. And how do people know how to navigate that? You know, when you're in crisis and now CPS is involved or you need medical attention because of the domestic violence and you don't know that there's such a thing as crime victims compensation that can help you with that, you know, there's so many, it's that old saying, the more you know, the more you don't know. When you're in crisis, folks really need help navigating our complex and sometimes convoluted systems. And so that's really at the crux of what the Coordinating Council is about. Does that make sense?
That's wonderful. Yes. Oh, absolutely. It does. So if an individual perhaps is listening right now and they reach out to you directly,
mm-hmm.
they get you on
mm-hmm.
the line, Barbie,
mm-hmm.
they get you.
Yes.
And
yes.
you've just shared that the system can be complex. And when
yes.
a woman has just, and her children have just experienced an event, a domestic violence
yes.
event, the last thing they want is you to set up an appointment to come and see them next week and, you know, that whole nine yards.
Yes.
So what is the emergency response in a situation like that? Because I really think, and I know you know, but you can clarify that for me, that there is great hesitancy on the part of a woman for many reasons. And by the
sure.
time she reaches out, by has gotten up enough courage and mental wherewithal to call somebody, you know, that
yeah.
that
yeah.
is a time where, look, I'm throwing out a lifeline here. Don't
yes.
make an appointment for me to come in a week or two.
Right.
So when you say that, let's talk about realities because, again, there are women who are suffering. There are women who are living in denial. When
yes.
they get up that courage, they dial that number. What are you going to say and do at that point? What happens?
Well, so, again, we're not a direct service provider, so we're not getting a lot of those calls, but we do get those calls. And there are domestic violence hotlines across the county that take those kinds of calls.
Yes.
The mm-hmm. very first thing that I do is assess safety. Are you safe? And let's talk about what that means. You know, is it safe for you to talk even right now? Do you need medical attention? Do you need police intervention? And then kind of for me it's assessing immediate safety and then moving into an assessment of where this person is in this process of change. You know, how do I tailor an intervention that meets you where you're at? So I need to hear from you, you know, tell me about the history of violence. Tell me about your support systems. Tell me about how I can support you and what you need to do that. And then I would make the connection to an advocacy program. So I would tell them what are the, I would give them a list of all the agencies that provide services to survivors and ask them which is the best referral for you and help them make that call. So help is available in terms of hotline 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You know, there's always somebody at the end of one of those hotlines that can do very much the same thing I just talked about. And then the next thing is unfortunately then setting up those appointments. And all of those agencies also offer residential and non-residential services. So residential services means that somebody needs to be in a safe place now and they can't be in their home, so they might need an emergency shelter. And there are 4 emergency shelters in our county that provide that kind of service.
And they are throughout the United States?
Yes, all over the United States. And then there are what's called non-residential services. So those are community-based services where folks can meet with an advocate, do this kind of risk assessment and safety planning, and then make connections to all the other kinds of resources that they may need. And what we know is that for many survivors, leaving is about finances. It's challenging and difficult to leave when I have 3 kids in tow, and how am I going to support myself and my kids when I'm leaving my financial support system? And that makes things very challenging and very scary for survivors to start to think about. And that's, again, where these agencies can help make those connections.
Okay.
Unfortunately, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'll save my question.
I was just going to say, unfortunately, what we know nationally is that less than 10% of victims of intimate partner violence will ever call a domestic violence program for help. So most of the folks, most of the families that are experiencing this power and control and imbalance and unhealthy relationships, intimate partner violence, most of the folks that are surviving this and living through this aren't reaching out for services from those domestic violence programs.
The other day I was out just kind of wandering around and doing a little stopping in a store here and there. And there was a woman standing next to me, and you know, chances are if you're standing close enough next to me, I'm going to start talking to you regardless of, you know, who you are.
Uh-huh.
This particular woman, though, had severe bruising in her face, severe,
mm-hmm.
particularly
mm-hmm.
around her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It was black and blue and yellowing. And I looked at her, and I was in front of her in line, and we were at a jewelry counter, and I looked at her, and I thought, okay, don't do it. You know you want to ask a question, but you don't know this lady, so don't do it. And
uh-huh.
I didn't win with myself. I said, hi, how are you? And she said, I'm fine. I said, well, I'm glad you feel fine because you got a little something going on there, don't you? And she said, well, yeah, I fell on my face.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, I've heard that story
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, my gosh, how horrible. And so I'm looking and I'm thinking, and, you know, I said, you fell on the sidewalk or the street? Or? She said, oh, yeah. Well, the interesting thing about that is that when that happens, there would have been definitely a significant amount of other type of damage to her face that
uh-huh.
would have, in my opinion, included some, these were just much too smooth as if it had come in contact with a smoother type of force that, and again, like you, I've seen it, and so I know
mm-hmm.
the story they tell. I know, and you know, I worked for several years with an agency, so, and inside of the shelter, so I
mm-hmm.
as a volunteer, so I know many of the stories, and I was so, you know, I did not want to be so presumptuous to tell her she needed to call somebody, but
right.
I read the whole thing because now, you know, I've been trained, and I read the
right.
whole scenario, and all I could do is in myself is say I just pray she'll get some help for
mm-hmm.
herself because that
right.
is so not, you know, so not looking good. But I don't want to get too far off track, but you are absolutely right. People are not, even with the severity of being battered, I have another close associate who went through it who has said to me, I will never tell you how
mm-hmm.
severe what I went through was. And
right.
I think to myself, I don't even know how you do that. How do you
right.
not say something that you're so threatened that someone will kill you that you won't say anything? This particular individual that I'm speaking of ultimately planned an escape and
uh-huh.
was able to do it in a very short time frame when the abuser had left home
uh-huh.
and
uh-huh.
Fortunately was able to, again, get away from that situation. But, gosh, if anything, I just want to encourage women to make that call, make that effort,
yes.
because
yes.
There were stories I heard of women living through it 20 years, 25
yes.
years, and
yes.
because they were so afraid they couldn't make it on their own. Things are a lot
yes.
different now. There's a lot of help. There's a lot of support. There are a lot of people who are going to help you connect the dots, who are going to help
right.
you be able to stand up and fight your own fight for
right.
your own survival and for your family. And so major message I want to get out today is please, please make that phone call. Please make
Absolutely.
That effort. If you have to do it with a quiet strategic plan over a couple of weeks, then just please do it. It's just
Absolutely.
not the thing to do to continue to jeopardize your own life and safety and that of your children if
right.
you have them. And so while we are there, Barbie, I want to bring this up because this is, you know, what you're connecting the dots for with people. There just seems to be so many more increasing incidences of violence and even more bizarre and unusual incidences than I can ever remember. And I don't know that maybe it has been occurring with to that extreme prior, and we just have quicker knowledge of it and more visible knowledge of it because
mm-hmm.
of the internet. But there
mm-hmm.
seem to be so many very unusual incidences of violence. And I'm asking this, you certainly are the expert. Are there any correlations that are becoming evident in what you all learn from these situations? I mean, it seems I can see when you say, well, I've experienced the violence and my dad abused me and so I abused my girlfriends and my wives, and it just seems to be so much bigger than that now than just a cycle, because this, it seems to carry such a very deviant component to it now. Some of the things
mm-hmm.
that are happening are just horrendous as far as the torture and the murdering of these women.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been made aware of, or is there any kind of correlation? Is it just higher stress levels because of how life is now? Is it internet? What would you tell us from your knowledge and experience?
Well, and just based on what I've known and what I've seen and what I've learned, I don't know that it's different, you know, as different now than, you know, maybe 30 years ago. I think that the media and the ready access to information means that we hear about those cases, right? And unfortunately, there's this idea that we want to hear about the worst of the worst, and that's what gets put out there. Just from what I know about the whole domestic violence and the domestic violence movement is that, you know, the domestic violence movement started with women sitting around, you know, kitchen tables, having coffee, talking about these relationships and not having any place to go and not knowing what to do about it. And, you know, that was the birth of the shelter movement in the United States. It was this very grassroots movement of women saying we've got to create places for people to go to be safe. So I don't know that it's more violent in intimate relationships today than it was, you know, 50 years ago. I think we just hear about it more. And what's unfortunate is that when we're hearing about it, it's sensationalized. Even just recently, you know, there was media here in the Harris County area, there was all this media attention about this young woman who had been strangled and left dead by her partner whom they were attempting to separate, and it was all over the news, but not one news media episode gave information about what folks can do to get help and said, you know, this is intimate partner violence, and when you're afraid for your life or when somebody's making threats or whenever this is happening, these are the numbers. You know, there wasn't a number flashing across the screen telling folks to, you can call 1-800-799-SAFE, which is the National Domestic Violence Hotline. We focus more on the bad, and we don't follow up with giving folks information about what to do and how to get safe. So, you know, I don't know, you know, I can't say to you that, yes, I think things are getting worse, because I don't, I don't really believe that they are. I think that they've always been not good. You know, we've really tolerated and accepted violence against women in intimate partner relationships as things that we don't talk about.
Can you talk about the psychology as you understand it of the abuser? Again, to give women a heads up on significant things to pay attention to. And I know I did ask your national director, Debbie Tucker, to reflect on some of those things, but I'd like to reiterate them.
Well, and what a treasure and wealth of knowledge Debbie Tucker is, and how wonderful to have her working along and kind of leading our efforts in our state. So thanks to her for all that she's done for so many years and continues
to
do.
Indeed.
You know, I'm sure she kind of talked about the power and control wheel and things that are used in relationships to gain power in relationships, things like economic abuse, controlling the finances in the family, not letting women have access to bank accounts or even knowing what kind of financial health exists for the family. You know, when I worked in the shelter, I tell this story about economic abuse because it hit me so hard when I heard this young woman sharing her story with me. She was about mid-20s, and she had 3 kiddos at the time she entered into the shelter, and it was the first time she attempted to leave. She had called the neighbors called the police because she had been kind of locked up in her home, and she found her way to the shelter and with these 3 kiddos in tow. And so we're kind of assessing where she's at and what she's needing, and we're talking about financial resources for herself, and she has no money and she's never worked. And she said, you know, when I was 16 years old, my family arranged for me to marry this man who was, you know, significantly older than me. And so I went from my parents' household, where I had never been in control of any money, to my now husband's home, where I had no idea of money and I didn't have skills and I didn't work. I stayed in the home. My husband did everything, paid the bills, bought the groceries, did everything. This young woman had no idea how much a pair of shoes cost for her child. She didn't know what it would take to put groceries on the table because she had been so controlled in this relationship. And I think that's a pretty big definition of a, you know, extreme economic abuse that was happening for her. So that's one form. You know, the other thing that I think is really important to talk about here is overly jealous and possessive. This person who wants to know where you're at all the time, keeps tabs on you, calls your workplace or your cell phone many times throughout the day. I think in the beginning of relationships, when that begins to happen, I think some women have this false sense that, you know, he must really be into me. He must really like me because he calls me all the time. He's very attentive. He wants to know where I'm at. And I would just caution folks that that's kind of a red flag for me. This is a person who is controlling of your time and who you're seeing and really trying to isolate, you know, it's a slow form of isolating you from friends, family, people that are your support system. I think that's another red flag that I would really encourage folks to think about. And, you know, the idea of emotional and psychological abuse, the person who, you know, puts you down and, you know, when we're in relationships with our significant others, we should feel good about ourselves. These should be relationships that make us feel better about who we are and better about our partner. And unfortunately, that's not what's happening, right? In terms of go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it lends itself to what you said earlier, that women often become so conditioned to certain types of relationship responses that they can't differentiate because they've never experienced anything that's in any category different than that.
Right.
When they go through the shelter. I know when I was there, one of the things that I did, my primary responsibility was in working with groups a couple of times a week to talk about your own self-esteem. And the idea and the strategy behind that was, of course, to help these women understand more about how capable they were, how special they were, how much they could see themselves differently if they wanted to take, you know, that challenge as an individual and be responsible for their. And very often I saw that, the whole idea was that I'm not complete until I am attached. But there definitely is a psychological breakthrough that needs to happen for the majority of women, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, I agree 100%. But I believe that there's help for both parties in this relationship, but it has to occur independently of the other. You know, I have to be whole and balanced and healthy myself before I can get into a healthy relationship, or even recognize what this healthy relationship should be and is. So, yes, I absolutely agree with you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I know it's my heartfelt thought that I would really love for them to experience what real love feels like, because definitely, once you experience it and know it, I don't know how you could choose to ever go back to anything that felt like pain or hurt again.
Exactly.
Well, we have a few minutes left that we can talk about some of the other services that people can reach out to get. I want to make sure that women understand that once they do approach an agency that, you know, there is also transitional housing and all kinds of things that can be provided as aid. So can you talk, and medical services, all kinds of things.
Yes.
So can you talk about the services that are available? Because, again, I think hesitancy and fear is because there's a big, what do I do now and how do I take care of myself? So let's have you talk about all of that for us.
Sure. So, again, I think the first step is making that call, and we're lucky in the United States that we have a national domestic violence hotline. And, again, the number is 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E. And that hotline, when you call that number, they can directly connect you to a service provider in your area, which is beautiful. And once you make that connection to the service provider in your area, what's been really great and what we've seen, the evolution of domestic violence programs in the United States over the last 25 years, is that they've really become this kind of one-stop shop program where you can get access to safe housing. So emergency shelter, of course, is one option, and that's, you know, for folks with a very limited amount of time to stay there. You know, I think most emergency shelters are about 30 days. You can apply to stay longer based on your needs. And then what happens when you go into the emergency shelters, one of the first things you're connected with is a caseworker or an advocate or a counselor, somebody to help you make all those connections to all those other sources of support that you need. And those include things like legal remedies. Do you need a protective order? And you have an advocate that can help walk you through that very complex system of gaining a protective order. Do you need to follow up with law enforcement or make a police report? There's someone there that can help you do that. Do you need medical attention? Do you need to apply in I think every state in the United States, they have crime victims compensation funds, which are funds that if you follow through with law enforcement and all the legal remedies that you need to follow through with, then you can access funds for medical care, counseling, relocation fees. The really important thing about crime victims compensation is if the domestic violence crime occurs in your home or your apartment, wherever you're living, you can apply for a one-time assistance of relocation where they actually help you pay for, you know, down deposit and down deposits for an apartment, as well as up to 3 months' rent, so that you can move to a safe location and never have to, you know, go to an emergency shelter or a program like that. The other thing about emergency shelters in the domestic violence realm is that many of them now have transitional housing, which is, you know, a year, 1 to 2 years of supportive programs and housing that include things like counseling and childcare and support groups. And then there's also permanent housing. So for folks that are that may be suffering from intimate partner violence as well as a disability of any kind, mental health or physical health, drug and alcohol abuse, HIV, those folks can apply for permanent housing programs where they need not ever move from. They can live there as long as that family determines they need to and still continue to receive all of these kinds of supportive services. So I think that's the real beauty of these domestic violence programs is that they've really thought holistically about what a person needs, and then they try to make sure that all of those components are a part of the program, and you have this advocate, this person to help you navigate that, to help you think about that, to help you walk through it so that you're not alone.
There's one thing you didn't mention that I want to ask about. I know that domestic violence does not have any it doesn't have its own social status. It's from the very, very poor to the very rich.
Yes.
But all, from the lowest to the highest, there are women who are lacking in skill sets for work.
Yes.
in every extreme. And so and in the middle. So I want to know where help is given or can be provided if there are programs, and I'm sure there are. I'm really just asking so you can tell us what kinds of programs are available that can offer work, skills, development, enrichment for these women.
There, many of these programs are incorporating what's called economic empowerment programs. So they're working on increasing the financial health for families, helping women really understand, you know, budgets and what it takes to feed a family of four and how much income you need to have. And then the Allstate Foundation has been really a champion in providing that kind of curriculum for domestic violence programs across the United States. So that's been a great thing that we've seen in the last few years. Also, the domestic violence programs have made connections with WorkSource and other vocational and technical kinds of programs so that women can learn a skill. Many programs offer GED classes at their site or at a community site that you can have easy access to. So women can start with getting their GED and then move into learning a skill or going to a vocational rehab program or something like that. They also kind of, the domestic violence programs know the other resources that have scholarship capabilities so that women can apply for scholarships. The Doris Buffett, the Sunshine Lady Foundation, has been a great resource in the United States for supporting survivors of domestic violence with scholarship funds to help them continue their education, which has been a great thing. And once you're connected with a domestic violence program, they can help you apply for those kinds of funds. So there's lots of things that are out there. I think when you make that connection to those advocates and those domestic violence programs, and they're assessing all the kinds of needs that you have, they create case plans to help them make those connections to those kinds of resources.
Yes, yes, thank you. I also want to make sure we do not close our conversation without recognizing that there is a lot of help for abusers.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. The battering intervention and prevention programs are the thing that we have now, the thing that's working. Well, the only thing that we know that's working. Often folks will refer to anger management programs and battering intervention programs as being the same thing, and they're very different. What's important for someone who's using violence in their intimate relationship, for them to learn how not to do that any longer, they need to be entering a battering intervention program. And when you call that 1-800-799-SAFE, they can help you make the connections to those programs as well.
Okay. Is there anything that you can say to them in particular? I know that I can tell them from the training that I have, the actual sessions, that I did experience men who were getting the treatment, who were getting the counseling that they needed and were feeling quite successful in what they were learning about themselves and understanding the anger process better and how to work with their own stressors and things like that. And so I do want to make sure that I say that there is a significant amount of support that's also available. I know that one of the hardest thing for both men and women is the shame factor, is the factor that everybody's going to know now that I'm, in quote unquote, this kind of person, that I do this horrible thing. Well, there are lots of people who have done horrible things. You just have to you know, get to the point where you can tell yourself that you'll have to forgive yourself and take a big giant step forward to say, I'm going to get the help that I need so I too can live a healthier and happier life and have a happier and healthier relationship going forward. So that would be my encouragement. Would there be anything that you would want to say as well?
You know, I love the way you said that, and I think if we only provide services to the victims of survivors, we're missing the boat. It's so important. I believe that people can change. I truly believe that there are men who use violence in their relationships that don't want to be doing that, that their intentions are not to hurt their partner. And it's, I love that you talked about this idea of shame and shame being something that prevents us from moving forward to get the help that we need. And if we can just remove that and folks who are using power and control in relationships can find the help to make that change, then we're all better for it.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's necessary. And when there is so much help out there, I just, you know, there's just no reason not to to go forward. You know, so many people have issues. All of us have something or another that we have had to fight and overcome. And regardless of how big this may seem or how embarrassing or hard, it's better for you in the long run before you create a life of self-destruction and then destroying other people's lives. And the reason that we put so much emphasis on what we have as far as the violence against the women and the children is because they are usually the ones on the receiving end who typically are the ones who need the most emergency response and care. And so that's the reason that there is so much emphasis. But definitely I know enough about it to know that men who are contributing to this, I've seen them totally heal them, their lives.
Absolutely.
And find, again, healthier and happy relationships and are truly all the better for it in all of life. So that's what I have to say about that in my Forrest Gump voice.
Good for you. Good for you.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say before we begin to wrap up? We have a few more minutes if there is. Otherwise, we're going to just have you give out the information once again and the hotline numbers. And hopefully we have been able to offer the right kind of support and encouragement in the direction of getting the help, because there definitely is help and hope. So anything else you'd like to say? If you want to, you can.
I think,
then go ahead and give out the information.
I think you just summed it up nicely. There is hope and there is help, and I just want folks to know they can call 1-800-799-SAFE, SAFE, the National Domestic Violence Hotline, to make that first step in getting help and finding the hope that they need to be safe and to be healthy and to know that, you know, you're not alone.
Absolutely. Well, Barbie, I want to thank you so much. This has been just as insightful and informative as I had expected, and I want to thank you. I know you've got to get back to work because I'm sure at the end of each day it's never done. But I want to thank you so much for sharing all of the expertise that you have, and I'm going to be doing a four-part series, and I may reach out to you again just to help answer some questions for me as I go forward in my attempt to really bring a big beacon light upon the situation and to get people moving again in the right direction of the help that they need.
Yeah.
So thank you once again.
Good for you.
And say hi to Amy. I'm sorry she couldn't join us today, but maybe next time.
Yes. Thank you so much for what you're doing, Silver Ray. You're this strong partner and strong voice for all of us, and I appreciate that so much.
And I appreciate you saying that. You have a wonderful day. I'll talk to you again before long.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Of course, as usual, I want to thank you listeners for being a part of the program today. And because this is such a critical topic, I am going to encourage you to share that I am doing this series on domestic violence, The Will to Win. Truly, as you have heard, there is a lot of help out there, and so there's hope for better, happier and healthier lives going forward. It can be overcome. This fight can be one. Well, I hope you have a marvelous day. Again, remind your friends about Foxology. Easy to get to, www.blogtalkradio.com/Foxology, or send them the link or something, but get them on board with the things that I'm doing, always trying to keep it positive, productive, informative, motivating, and inspiring. And you know what? I hope that's what your day is like. Thank you so much for tuning in.